Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Two guests today. We'll hear first from the geographer, journalist, and activist Melissa Figueroa on the Amazon fires. And at the bottom of the hour, Anton Yeager will talk about the history and ideology of populism and its relevance today. Sad to say, the fires in the Amazon have fallen out of the news somewhat, partially eclipsed by another sign of the climate crisis, Hurricane Dorian. But they're still worth some attention. My first guest, Melissa Figueroa, spent a lot of time in the Amazon, studying its ecology and the people who live there. She's a PhD candidate in geography at UC Berkeley, a fellow at the Liberty Tree Foundation for Democratic Revolution, and a longtime political journalist, educator, and organizer. In her academic life, she worked with Susanna Hecht, a geographer who studied the Amazon and helped create the field of political ecology, which is part of the reason the interview opens with a discussion of her work. Melissa Figueroa. To prepare for this, I pulled The Fate of the Forest, that book by Susanna Hecht and Alexander Coburn, off the shelf. I have the old edition from 1989, not the newer one. And first thing I see in the dust jacket, the first two sentences of the dust jacket copy are, "Why is the Amazon rainforest burning? How much forest is left and how can it be saved?" Now, this was 30 years ago. People were asking these questions. What about this history? To start with, fires have been a longstanding feature of life in the Amazon, correct?
Absolutely. Actually, in fact, it's responsible for a lot of the forest itself, as we're starting to learn now from archaeologists and historical ecologists. Some scholars estimate that up to 15% of the Amazon is actually anthropogenic and cultivated. And the basis for that is the existence of what's called teja preta, which is our black soils, which is formed by burning. It's kind of like the original biochar. Some of that soil is 50 meters deep in some places. It's the most fertile soil in the world, which is totally contrary to a lot of tropical ecology, that regular soils in tropical forests tend to be very nutrient poor. So as we can see, burning is actually one of the bases of what makes the forest so fascinating and so awesome to a lot of us. But that's a different kind of burning, right? That's a burning that has to do with traditional practices. It has to do with soil amendment, shifting cultivation, and that's generally done on a small scale. The burning that we're all of us are outraged about in the Amazon right now is about a fundamental transition from forest cover to pasture, or to monoculture, industrial agriculture, which is what's going on now.
And when did this transition start?
Susanna's also written a great book on the deep history of the Amazon from the rubber period and from other things. The forest has always been an economic engine and a site of extraction for a lot of resources. A lot of what has been going on in terms of deforestation did happen in the 1970s under the military dictatorship that, for quote-unquote national security reasons, decided to move a lot of people into the Amazon in order to integrate. I mean, and you're hearing a lot of this language now. Even Bolsonaro talks about it, the quote-unquote national integration of this giant frontier into sort of the national territory. And in the 70s, that meant securing the western borders. And so a bunch of people from the northeast of the country, which was experiencing droughts, were moved in and given free land. But along with that came a lot of logging, a lot of gold mining, and a lot of cattle ranching. I guess it's important to say here that cattle ranching is not just for burgers or whatever. Cattle is a way of claiming land. So under Brazilian land law, you can claim land that is otherwise unclaimed or abandoned by showing that you are able to improve the land. So it's the principle of, like, who improves the land can have it. And so cattle ranching, of course, is the most visible way of saying, oh, I'm making use of this land for pasture. And so a lot of what we're seeing is not just about cattle, but it's about a land rush and the imposition of private property.
Once they have possession of that land, what do they do with it, aside from the cattle grazing?
All kinds of things, I guess. There are, of course, the logging interests who take out the trees. There are land speculators, what are called grileros, or crickets, or locusts, that are about property speculation. So, like, they claim plots, they sell them. There's mining interests, both large companies and, you know, just poor people who want to go prospecting, like the classic California gold rush. And of course, a lot of, especially the large landowning class, that's like sort of the historical rural elites of the country, that assume it's theirs and they like just come and take it. So you have large farms as well. And of course, most recently, you have soy agribusiness that's hand in hand with transnational companies to come. Although I have to say, most recently, soy agribusiness has been trying to talk about kind of like environmentally friendly soy that doesn't rely on a lot of forest clearing. It's just a mixture of different kinds of capitalist interests and land speculators that just kind of go in. It's one of the last great frontiers, although it's not virgin land that's being converted, but it is trying to be integrated into global circuits.
According to what I read on Facebook, the forests are burning to satisfy our insatiable demand for burgers and steaks. How accurate a picture is that?
It's not really. This is the thing that again, annoyed me and like kind of prompted me to start talking about this, is because very little actual Brazilian beef makes it to the United States, and very little soy actually comes to feed our cows. The bulk of Brazilian exports goes to China, and increasingly it goes to the EU. One of the things that some folks and I were speculating about was that Mercosur, this South American trade bloc, has just signed an agreement with the EU that would double the exports of Brazilian beef to the EU. So, I mean, there is some potential for people in the EU to put pressure upon that trade deal. But in terms of the United States, it really won't affect their company's bottom line in any way. Not only that, right? Soy is like, you know, and I've been to these places. I've been to the Cargill plant. I've been in hotels overhearing some of these people talking, and they don't really care. Soy can be used for anything from plastic to eco-friendly products to car seats to biodiesel to fake meat, right? And the Impossible Burger, which is made from soy protein. They're in the business of growing soy and shipping it out. They don't really care how it ends up on the other end. And not only that, Archer Daniels Midland, which is very heavily invested in Brazilian soy, has an exclusive patent on textured vegetable protein, which is the basis for fake meats and the soy protein that's used in many vegan diets. Not only does reducing our beef consumption not affect their bottom line, there is a chance that if you switch to Impossible Burgers, you may actually be enhancing their bottom line. You know, it's these kinds of subtleties that people really need to understand if they're really, really wanting to affect what's going on instead of just satisfying their own need to feel good.
After the land is cleared and converted to pasture, how stable is that, ecologically speaking? Will it stay as pasture, or is it a constant battle to keep it tamed as such?
It depends on the ecological context, shall we say. In small-scale shifting cultivation practices, if you're a peasant, say, and you sort of clear out a couple of hectares to grow some stuff, and then once you exhaust that portion, you move on to another, that's like a more sustainable practice, because you're, once you stop cultivating that plot, you leave it fallow, and that lets the forest grow back. In pasture lands, especially when like vast amounts of forest are cleared out, it has the effect of drying out the ecosystem, so that it does make it harder for it to grow back. And so that's, you know, part of the fear of what's called forest dieback. There's been like persistent drought in the Amazon for at least the last 5 years, at least since the last time I was there. When I was there, it was consistently over 100 degrees, and especially in the soy zones and in the pasture zones, it was much drier and much hotter. And so part of the fears that ecologists are looking at is that the forest will be fragmented to the point that it won't be able to bounce back, that it will tip towards drying out rather than restoring itself.
Now, another thing we read on Facebook and in the news is that the Amazon is the lungs of the planet, and these fires will be the death knell for life on Earth. What about that?
Yeah, it's not the lungs of the Earth. I mean, and that's another thing, too. We've both seen an article from Forbes in which pro-business media tries to hook on to some of those inaccuracies in order to dismiss the activist outrage and the concerns around the Amazon. The fact is that, you know, what all that the oxygen, and it does produce a ton of oxygen that the forest produces, is generally absorbed back by the people and the animals and the other oxygen users that live in the Amazon. So it basically is its own cycle. Where it is really, really crucial is for climate regulation. So, you know, as I said in my post, it was it's more like the hypothalamus of the Earth, where it sort of distributes temperature and heat around the Earth's surface. It's not quite as charismatic a phrase, but what forest dieback would do is accelerate the process of global warming. But that's also why, again, the image overall that people who are not from the Amazon get of this forest as like this vast natural system that does its thing on its own is also something that we need to kind of adjust, because, you know, the Amazon has always had people in it. It's always had this conscious tending of the ecosystem for millennia. You know, that's what the archaeologists are saying. And so the idea of having people on the land to manage it, having the right people on the land to manage it, meaning the people who have learned how to deal with the dynamics of the forest, is really, really key. Again, you know, when you have a peasant that's just doing shifting cultivation, that's one way of managing the forest and letting it grow back, as opposed to a large, you know, a fazendero, like a rancher, or you know, a transnational soy corporation who's just going to go and clear out huge patches. One of the things that I've been really very adamant about is to remember that there are people in the forest, and a lot of those people are the ones who are responsible for maintaining the ecosystem.
There's a kind of consciousness among some Northern Hemisphere environmentalists that the forest just is a preserve, kind of national park consciousness, and it needs to be just fenced off and left to itself. But obviously that erases the people who live there and their importance to the maintenance of the ecosystem.
Absolutely. It's not just for the Amazon, it's indigenous and traditional peoples in general. In the Amazon, it's also not just indigenous. It's not just the Yanomami, and it's not just these tribes that people imagine live in some kind of pre-modern state. There are rubber tappers. There are quilombolas, who are the descendants of enslaved Africans who escaped into the forest centuries ago. There are all kinds of people, even some of the peasants, right, who were moved onto the land in the 1970s, who now grow acai and Brazil nuts and other things, non-timber forest products, and sell them on global markets. It's about the people who learn to manage the forest in different ways. And that's true also of, you know, indigenous peoples around the world. I live in fire country in California, and I've been talking a lot with indigenous people of this area who are like, this land is not managed properly. The fuel is allowed to build up for these giant wildfires to come and eat up whole towns. And so the idea of like actually thinking about humans as not antithetical to environments, but rather the keystone species of these environments is really, really important, I think, for us all. And it's one of these things where being able to grasp the reality of the Amazon actually is the key to helping all of us, right, deal with climate change, deal with a renewed relationship to our environment that's not an industrial capitalist paradigm.
I'm speaking with a geographer, journalist, and activist, Melissa Figueroa. Fires are not new, and deforestation is not new, and you know, pasteurization is not new. What is new about what's been happening recently, and what is new about Bolsonaro's regime?
Right. So there's that other claim that the fires that are happening now aren't as bad as what it was in the past. And that is actually true. You have apparently this year, the projections are that it's going to be 80% more than it was in the last decade. But this last decade has seen 75% decline in deforestation since the early 2000s and even before that.
And was that the Lula government that was responsible for that?
A lot of it was the Lula government, although, again, there was a lot of compromising positions going on because it had to balance the needs of the social movements with neoliberal capitalism. But yes, having a government, right, that was friendly to the social movements, that came out of the social movements, you know, the Workers' Party came out of that collaboration between, you know, social movements, trade unions. It had a movement past. And also Marina Silva, who was a minister of the environment from the early 2000s, played a key role. And she was from the Rubber Tappers Union as well. And that kind of, you know, in an interesting way is kind of, was both the strength and as we see now, the downfall of the social movements that fought for the reserve system, the system of conservation units in Amazonia, that's you know, was one of the most sophisticated conservation systems in the world because it integrated that role of people and their livelihoods into it. And the social movements really should take the credit for the decline in deforestation and the ability to stem that tide. And that's exactly what's happening now. Although the over-reliance, even when I was there in 2015, 2016, and I was talking to some of these movements, there was that concern because the coup, the parliamentary coup against Dilma Rousseff had taken place, like actually while I was there. And there was a lot of talk about like maybe there what had been an over-reliance on the federal government for the protection and the enforcement of the conservation reserves. And that's exactly what we're seeing an unraveling of now. Bolsonaro, you know, his whole campaign was an attack, a genocidal attack on the indigenous and traditional peoples, and said, like, why is 14% of Brazil's territory the property of these little bands of primitive Indians and that kind of thing? You know, they've been wanting access to that land. They've been wanting to own that land, the elites, for 30 some years now. And so it was Bolsonaro's a systematic dismantling of the network of federal agencies and NGOs that actually kept the conservation system intact. And when he finally, I think it was in April or May, when he announced that the government monitoring and enforcement agency, IBAMA, would A, no longer be able to enforce conservation on the ground. So when they stripped IBAMA of the power to stop people on the ground from deforesting, and also said that he would not support the agency in any of its enforcement activity, that basically opened the floodgates for all of the interests, the miners, the loggers, the fazendeiros, the land speculators, to basically go in and invade the conservation areas. So if you look at the map of where the fires are happening now, and you superimpose that on a map of the conservation units in Amazonia, you can see that the fires are deliberately happening in and around those areas. This is why it's important to look at this as the as a political move, right? Instead of just the sort of the normal, you know, business as usual. This is a revenge act of the elites who were cut off from those areas to try and claim them and again, and exploit them.
There's almost a nihilism about this. I mean, it sounds like a lot like Trump and the people around him. They view the melting of the Arctic ice caps as an opportunity to drill for oil. I mean, there's something really deeply nihilist about this worldview.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, you see at the same time that the Amazon is burning, the Congo is burning, and Trump goes into the Alaskan forest. I wouldn't say it was climate denialism as much as I think they know the jig is up. And I know you've talked about it a lot that, you know, the sort of the faltering of global markets and the slowdown that is and the coming recession, I think on the part of the elites and the capitalists, they're trying to just grab everything they can before the party's over, which has that effect of self-fulfilling that prophecy of, like, you know, hastening the demise of the earth.
Bolsonaro and the folks he's working on behalf of, what do they want to do to the Amazon ultimately?
They see the Amazon as a resource. They see the trees as dollar bills. They see the land as a source of capital and a source of wealth. And, you know, that's what they ultimately are after. In Brazil, land ownership is the most unequal in the world. I think something like the top 1% owns something like 40% of the land. And so the idea that 14% of the Brazilian territory was cut out of the private property system, I think was something that has been, you know, very, very offensive to their worldview. The elites, especially the sort of old school elite in Brazil, are, like, you know, revanchist to colonial era traditions. And so they want to colonize that last 14%. They want to make claim over it, make it theirs, and plunder the resources underneath. Bolsonaro himself, when he talks about it, says, you know, there's too much land for too little Indians, and it's not fair, he says, that these people have control over the richest area in the world. They're looking at it in terms of, we need to get ours, right? And just have total disregard for its priceless ecological value for the rest of us.
Bolsonaro and his crowd tend to play a nationalist card too, don't they? That anyone who is concerned about the burning is just some sort of meddling foreigner, and, you know, do good NGOs and all these people are just need to get out of the way of Brazilian self-determination. How do you counter that rhetoric?
Yeah, and that's an old line from the authoritarian period. The generals, too, were saying that it's this colonial infringement on Brazilian sovereignty. What I would counter that with is that actually the indigenous peoples have sovereignty. It's in the Brazilian constitution. Indigenous people have what are called originary rights over their ancestral territories, meaning that legally, within the framework of the constitution, their rights to the land and their traditional way of life predates the state. Actually, they have rights regardless of what the state has. So that's why recognizing that there are people in the forest and they have sovereignty is one way of saying, instead of us colonially going and abrogating Brazilian sovereignty, the Brazilian state is abrogating the sovereignty of indigenous peoples. That's one way that I would reframe the issue in order to sort of get around that.
So what can people outside Brazil do to stop the destruction of the Amazon?
It's hard because it takes a lot more political agitation than just not eating burgers. One of the things that we can do, again, is uplift and put front and center the struggles of indigenous peoples and traditional peoples to reframe these fires as really an attack upon them and their sovereignty. This is also in line with the struggles of indigenous peoples all over the world, from Standing Rock to the Adani coal mine in Australia to Mauna Kea. Right now, indigenous peoples' territories are under attack from capital, who wants to basically complete its conquest of the world. So political agitation on that front is very key. If we really learn what the connections are in the Amazon, there are ways that we can press on certain levers of pressure. So, you know, one of the things I've been thinking about is that the state of California has a carbon offset contract with the state of Acre, where the preservation of the conservation units there offset carbon emissions in California. Now, you know, as dubious as a lot of people rightly think carbon offsets are, that is a political lever that we can use to, say, pressure Governor Newsom for increased standards and enforcement of that carbon offset contract. That's something that could have some political legs because Gavin Newsom wants to be the climate governor, right? People in the EU can pressure that deal with Mercosur in whatever ways, recalling the anti-globalization movements of the 90s. So it's about thinking about where the pressures are. And ultimately, it's going to be about supporting the social movements in Brazil as a whole. The social movements like Elinau, that movement, the movement of women, of LGBT people, of peasants, of indigenous peoples and quilombolas, because they are in that fight right now against Bolsonaro. It's really about getting Bolsonaro and his cronies out of power, because ultimately that is where the state is what's going to make the difference between enforcing conservation or encouraging deforestation. So our solidarity with the movements within Brazil who are fighting that government right now is one of the best things that we can do.
I was Melissa Figueroa, a geographer, journalist, and activist. Her website is melfig.net. Some of her thoughts on the fires can be found on the website of Capitalism, Nature, Socialism at cnsjournal.org. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break.
The greatest loss of them all. The culture is waiting ahead of all. I guess that I'm burned out after all. This is it, I'm signing off. Miss doing nothing the most of all. Oh, I just missed a fireball. LA's in flames, it's getting hot. Kanye West is blonde and gone. Life on Mars ain't just a song. Oh, the life stream's almost on.
That was some of the greatest from Lana Del Rey's fabulous new album. My younger self would have laughed at me for how much I like her work, but time does that to one. Next, populism, a word that's in wide and often reckless use. The Financial Times uses it to refer to right-wing creeps like Trump and neo-Nazis in Germany and Austria. But that's not a very helpful use. Anton Yeager has a piece on the Jacobin website discussing the American kind, which seemed like an excellent topic for a conversation. Yeager is a PhD candidate in history at Cambridge, writing on the history of American populism. Anton Yeager. What do we mean by populism? It seems to be a word that eludes definition very often. Other than the centralizing of the people, what does it mean?
Well, I think you could go for contemporary or for historical definitions. And the historical definitions are quite varied, but if we want to start with the contemporary one, I think populism really denotes... There are a lot of scholars of populism out there who I disagree with a lot, but I think the definition of populism that's very prevalent now is that it's basically an ideology that divides the population into two groups. Two groups are perfectly homogenous, and the idea is that you can derive a kind of politics from those... the opposition between two groups that proclaims that a homogenous people needs to oppose an elite. And I think this is a pretty good definition. I mean, we can look at several movements that kind of fit the bill there. But I think you need to look at the specific kind of institutional requirements for why this kind of politics becomes possible today, or why it is possible for so many politicians to invoke the people as a kind of coherent social group today. And that really has to do with the decline of big mediating institutions between individual and state. So it has to do with the decline of party democracy, the decline of unions, the decline of cooperatives, but also the decline of churches. So populism is a kind of anti-intermediary form of politics that allows you to take a shortcut between people and elite. And historically, when you look, this picture is actually way more complicated, and it's exactly for that reason that I'd like to go back to the late 19th century when the word populism was first introduced into our vocabulary in the American case, because it's both very interesting, but it also complicates the picture.
It's funny what you describe, this aversion to institutions. It has a lot in common with American Protestantism, which is all about the individual and his direct relationship with God, and we don't want any intervening institutions like those cursed papists have.
That's absolutely right, yeah. And it's no surprise that the original American populists in the late 19th century were all convinced Methodists. Some of them were evangelicals, but most of them came from a Methodist background. And after they lose their last election in 1896, all of them become anti-Catholics, but like fiercely anti-Catholic thinkers. Not all of the populists, but some very prominent ones. And the argument they use is precisely about intermediary institution, because Catholicism is not only a problem because of the Pope, but also the politics of Catholicism is that it places these kind of intermediary bodies between individual and state. It has a priesthood. It kind of mediates an individual's relationship to God. And this is a religious argument that's actually very much a political argument, in the sense that they want to say, well, there shouldn't be any kind of institution between the individual and its leader and the state. Although I think in the 1880s, 1890s, when there's this kind of cooperative moment in American populism, this relationship becomes far more difficult. But it's true, it is a Protestant heritage.
It's funny because, you know, I grew up Catholic and I left it behind, but I think it still bears its mark on me.
You mean in those... Oh, yeah, go ahead, sorry.
Just in my preference for the institutional and my aversion to that kind of individualistic politics that a lot of populism seems to participate in.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, I can understand.
Well, let's go back to the 19th century. I mean, the social base of 19th century populism was very rural. It was not an urban working class movement. And in some ways, it was set against the urban working class because farmers wanted higher food prices, and that would not be good news for the urban working class. But talk some about that 19th century base of American populism.
Yes, so it started overwhelmingly rural, mainly in sort of Texan farming communities in the 1870s, and then it moved into the whole Midwest and the South in the 1880s. And if we know anything about the political economy, mainly about the post-war South, it's really a very, very messy conglomeration of classes. So you have some smallholders and yeomen, you have a lot of people who are sliding into tenantry. A lot of these yeomen are also sliding into tenantry because they've got a lot of debts. Then, of course, you have ex-slaves. So most black farmers are in sharecropping. Some of them are already in wage labor. And then you also have a rising number, of course, of just industrial laborers, not everywhere in the South, but there is already a sizable number. And it's actually on this kind of really complicated social base on which populism builds a kind of coalition. And they managed to build quite an impressive coalition. And even in the late 1880s, they reach out to urban workers as well. But the kind of rural center of the movement was never really transcended. Interestingly enough, when Eugene V. Debs runs for president in the early 20th century, who was a populist in the 1890s, a lot of his highest tallies are actually received in these rural areas. So there is a kind of radical heritage to populism that later made these kind of farmers a very valuable constituency for socialists. But the big, big issue in the 1890s, when they lose the election against the Republicans in 1896, is mainly that they can't actually convince these urban, mainly Catholic workers who tend to stick with other parties.
Populism has some roots in the Jeffersonian worldview, you know, the love of the yeoman farmer, which even though Jefferson himself ran something of a factory with 200 slaves, he perpetrated this ideal of the self-reliant farmer as the basis for American democracy, and really contemptuous of cities. So that Jeffersonian heritage was really a deep part of populism in the later in the century, wasn't it?
It was, although they do realize the contradictions and untenability of this kind of easy Jeffersonianism in the late 19th century. So they're very much wedded to an individualist notion of farming, but the economy itself, or the sort of agricultural crisis that rises in the 1880s, completely negates this individualist ideal. And partly also because the definition of who counts as a farmer, who counts as a producer, has expanded quite drastically, because you have wage laborers, you now also have a sizable number of a population are now black farmers. So this really calls into question this kind of Jeffersonian heritage, and it forces them to rethink what it means to be a producer in the late 19th century. And the kind of cooperative movement they start in the 1880s, 1890s is actually a really interesting attempt to transcend individualism and to accept things such as corporate personality, for example, or to have cooperatives in which kind of individual production gets untied from social production, for that sense. So Jeffersonianism enters into crisis, mainly at the same time as the economic crisis, and the figure of the producer has to be expanded. And I think philosophically that's an interesting moment, because it's a contradiction and it shows a kind of schizophrenia, but at the same time it's also productive, because it allows you to rethink this tradition in a potentially interesting way, I think.
The economic background of the late 19th century was one of deflation and repeated recession and depression. Prices declined for like almost 30 years fairly steadily. And, you know, I think we almost half the time of the late 19th century was spent in some kind of economic contraction. And we now have not that exactly, but something somewhat like that. The American economy is just not growing very rapidly, and it's, you know, non-inflationary, deflationary kind of feel to it. What about that economic environment and its parallels to the present?
Well, there's a reason we talk about the first and the second Gilded Age. So that's become a very recurrent trope, even in scholarly discussions, the idea that the late 19th century and our age share a lot of similarities. So as you say, there's a deflation question. There's a question of economic globalization, in the sense it was the first time all these nations became economically interdependent. And obviously, it was also a time of populism, or the time in which certain groups started to do politics in the name of the people. I think the big difference, though, is that even though you had these heavy contractions in the late 19th century, it was also in a time of really, really aggressive growth. So even if you had massive speculative bubbles in railroads, for example, and you had crashes where enormous amounts of stocks were liquidated, in the end, the railroads were still built, and there was a kind of productive surge that is completely unlike anything we see today, in which there are contractions, but growth is still anemic and very, very low. And I think it shows us the difference between the populism we knew in the late 19th century and the populism we know today, is that late 19th century populism was facing an enormously dynamic economy. And the question it had is, okay, this economy is deeply irrational. It's prone to very, very sudden market shocks. What can we do to both rationalize this economy and to rethink the terms of the economy itself? While the populism we find today is faced with a kind of historical helplessness, almost, where it has a kind of nostalgia for a certain kind of post-war mode of production that has become infrastructurally very, very difficult to maintain. So I don't really agree with calling Trump a populist in principle, but the rhetoric that is used, or the way he regards America's political economy, really runs into those contradictions.
Yeah, Uber is really not of a scale with the Transcontinental Railroad.
No, absolutely not, no.
At the turn of the century, the 19th and the 20th, that is, we saw the emergence of the large corporation, the development of professional management, the classic separation of ownership and control. What did this do to populist thinking?
Yeah, this is a very interesting discussion, mainly because the kind of rise of the corporate economy you saw in the 1870s and 1880s is both amazing and appalling for populists, because they see these corporations do incredibly complex logistical operations. I mean, building these kind of railroads is really a sort of unseen act of industrial engineering in that sense. But at the same time, of course, railroads are also monopolistic entities, so they can engage in price gouging. So they find it both amazing and appalling. And at first, they also refuse this kind of separation of ownership and control in the corporation, because they think that the only way to have reliable political agents, or the only way for a citizen to have an independent political will, is if they have a connection to private property. So the idea with the yeoman farmer Jefferson celebrates is, well, you have your own farm, you can work on it, and you produce your own products, not for a boss. Once you finish your products, you can go into the market and you can sell those freely if there are no middlemen that will stop you in that transaction. And the corporation really completely shatters this bond between property and will. So the idea is that a corporation has socialized property, because it has stockholders, it has shareholders that actually own the property, while the manager just takes care of the property and supervises it. And it's interesting that in the 1880s and the 1890s, when the populists start their own cooperatives and they build these kind of exchanges, they do take over some of these corporate principles. So they introduce separations between ownership and control. They have managers, they have shareholders, so every member of a cooperative is actually an official shareholder in these exchanges. But obviously, they lose out to these corporate opponents. And it's only in the late 1890s, when this kind of fight between the cooperatives and the corporate entities ends, that they shift back to this kind of individualist position, where they say, like, the corporation is intrinsically problematic and there is no way you should be organizing an economy around this entity.
I was speaking with Anton Yeager, a Cambridge PhD student who's writing about American populism. A socialist at the time greeted the corporation with some degree of approval. That is, the organization of production on such a large scale was promising for a socialist future. But also, the separation of ownership and control showed that we didn't really need a capitalist class. We could have professional managers running things in the interests of the working class. And Marx even says somewhat similar things in the third volume of Capital, where the emergence of the corporate form is a kind of prefiguration of a more socialist organization of an economy. The populists were pretty much against that, although with the exceptions you note. And this debate now seems lost. You know, we've seen a lot of people on the left criticizing the corporate form, and any notion that there's something progressive about it seems somewhat forgotten. What about that fight around the corporation?
I think I would prefer a sort of dialectical take on it. I think the corporate form is obviously something worth retaining, and I think it's an emancipatory device, not only because it socializes production, but also, as you say, because it lets go of this kind of fetish of private property that has addled a lot of people on the left as well, where the ideal of a small year old farmer continues to stalk our imaginary. The way I would retain something of the populist critique is that there was often a tendency towards technocracy implicit in some of these socialist celebrations of the corporation or the rise of the managerial class. So the issue is that the rise of the managerial class is fine. The only thing that needs to happen is that the mentality of the managers or the people who are in charge of production needs to change, and they need to become more rational managers, basically. So there's this idea of the Soviet of engineers. And although there are democratic variants of the Soviet of engineers, there were also certain currents, for example, in British Fabianism that had a highly technocratic, almost anti-democratic notion of what this kind of corporate socialism would look like. And I think, although we do not have to retain the critique of the corporate form from populists themselves, I think we need to think very carefully what it means to democratize a corporation, which is an even more dazzling and difficult question today, where you have these huge multinational corporations that of global supply chains. And the question of how you would democratize an entity like that is obviously very important, but it's also not an easy question. Like, it requires a lot of hard thought. And I think you can rely on some of the democratic discussion or some of the questions that were thrown up in the 1890s. It's like, okay, we can have corporations, but how do we keep them democratic? And still say, well, the corporate form in and itself is not a problem.
I agree with you. That needs to be thought through, and it's a very difficult challenge. But on the other hand, I don't see an awful lot of people working on that problem.
Absolutely not, no. So Lee Phillips and Michael Rosorowski's book on Walmart, for example, does a good attempt at it. But I think it sidesteps the question of what the politics of deliberation are within this corporation or within this large firm. So there's a lot of talk, for example, about deep data, and there's a lot of talk of these latest algorithmic innovations. But I think, well, what we've become very good at some of these technical questions, but the political question of how you organize the communication of needs within these big capitalist firms, I don't think we've advanced that far beyond the late 19th century. I think the sort of institutional solutions that are available have not changed that dramatically, and I think we've lost a lot of time not thinking about those. So Vivek Chira made this point quite well, where he says, like, can we have less analysis of sort of romance movies from a Marxist perspective, and can we actually think about planning and how we might combine planning with democracy.
On the left, a lot of people have really taken up some of the populist tradition in fondness for localism and small-scale production. Somehow this fantasy that smaller businesses are more rooted in communities and more attentive and more caring and less cynical and brutal. So there's been actually a detour from the thinking through of the corporate form that we need because people are lost in some nostalgia for a world that never really was.
Yeah, definitely. I think that localist tendency definitely exists on the left as well. The question we need to ask, though, is that the reason there is a turn towards localism, or the reason people feel that only small production is viable or is democratically viable in such a large economy, is mainly because the challenge of democratizing this corporation is so dazzling and so big that it induces this kind of recoil that makes people want to go back to small production. And the difficult thing about the populists is actually that they want to have their cake and eat it. They both want to retain some forms of local production, but they also want railroads to continue existing and to organize production or to organize supply chains transnationally. And they have an attempt to kind of democratize this notion of a railroad or democratize the notion of a middleman, which they don't succeed, but I think we need to return to some of their challenges, because obviously we're not taking them up today.
And now in the present, we've seen an enormous growth in conversation about socialism in the U.S. over the last several years, which is, for someone like me who's been around the left for decades, quite stunning, because what left there was very much a localist, populist, small-scale kind of thing in the 80s and 90s and into the 2000s. So this transition to a more socialist kind of discourse is quite shocking. But are we thinking about these things in these kinds of terms when we talk about socialism? What are we thinking about when we talk about socialism? Or are we still under the influence of these inherited populist ideas?
Well, I mean, when I speak to people who've experienced 2000s politically, and I kind of hear what kind of ideas were circulating at the time, I always am assured that things have gotten a lot better. The debate is a lot healthier. It's not necessarily expressed itself in any kind of big politics yet, but the ideas or the intellectual activity that's going on is definitely far more interesting.
I completely confirm that, let me tell you.
Okay, that's also a healthy confirmation to have. I think where populism still plays into it, or where there's a kind of populist impulse that drives a lot of socialism, which I think I don't disagree with necessarily, is that the way people have experienced the global crisis of the last 10 years or the sort of post-2008 crash is not just in a sort of monetary utilitarian sense of wages have stagnated and I have less money, which a lot of people, of course, have. But the way the crisis has been experienced is mainly as a crisis of political agency. So there is really no control people have had over the kind of governments that have managed the outfall of the crisis. There is really no institutional superstructure that people can use to actually force different decisions on their political classes. And what's so powerful, both from populism for the left and on the right today, is that it takes collective agency very seriously. Unlike a lot of liberals, it says, well, no, collective agency or the necessity of collective action is a fact. We just need to think through how we can act collectively again. So the localist impulse might have disappeared and people are thinking big again, as the Walmart book demonstrates quite insightfully, I think. But the question of how you combine collective agency and complexity, or how do you combine an economy of scale with people acting collectively, still drives a lot of socialist discourse. And I think that can go the wrong way, because obviously right-wing populists have a solution to a collective agency that's just, okay, we'll have plebiscitarian leadership where people just vote for this strong presidential figure. But I think it's worth retaining on the left, but the question is like, yeah, how the hell do you reconcile democracy and complexity today?
Let's go back to the 19th century a moment. The figure of Tom Watson, who went from populist firebrand to a racist landowner. Was that just a personal accident, or does that tell us something about populism itself? And relatedly, you know, the way the right has been so able to appropriate populist language for its own ends is impressive. Is that something inherent in populism that should excite our suspicions?
I wouldn't go as far to call it inherent. I think it's definitely possible, and the fact that it's possible shows it's interesting, and it needs to be very seriously taken very seriously from the left, because a response that's often given from the left to Watson's degeneration, to a sort of racist patriarch, is often, oh, he was syphilitic, he lost a child, so he's completely traumatized by this. So they reduce this to questions of personal psychology, but then they completely underestimate the fact that, well, I mean, Watson had a big constituency even after he lost his last election. Like, even when he was a racist landowner, he had a newspaper that was read by thousands in the South, and he was able to win elections. So the question is not just personal, it's like, well, no, he stands for a certain kind of politics, that it's obviously viable. And there, I think indeed that some of the ambiguities of the populist discourse he had in the 1890s, where you had this opposition between producers and parasites, and it was never quite clear who counted as a producer, because sometimes they'd be against big robber barons, they'd be against big industrial employers, and they say, like, these people are exploiting their workers. While at times some of the farmer intellectuals in the populist party were like, oh no, we actually need an alliance with these kind of productive parts of capital. And it's this kind of opening where the flexibility of this concept of the producer actually leads you to build very, very suspicious interclass fronts. So what Watson did is that, as a landowner, he was able to rally a lot of white wage laborers, both against Jewish factory owners, but then also against his black workforce. And I think the flexibility of populist discourse made this a possibility. So we need to take into account that populism can go both ways. That doesn't mean it's intrinsically bad, but you can do very bad things with it. And if we underestimate that, as we see today, then it still is dangerous.
Yeah, that producerist ideology was able to see black welfare mothers as parasites in the same way that, you know, big business was in the 80s and 90s leading up to welfare reform.
Yeah, absolutely. So producerism, I think, is actually a cyclical occurrence in capitalism, because capitalism works in these waves, and then it has, you could call, sort of really energetic and productive moments, and then it has moments of decline. And what happens in these moments of decline is that a part of the capitalist class actually has to go back to this producerist ideology to strengthen its hand against a different section of the capitalist class. So you have a rentier, sort of unproductive, parasitical costs, that is only engaged in finance and that basically just moves money around. And then you have people who actually own factories, who own very hard and concrete things they produce things with. And it's true that producerism, for example, was a very important part of Nazism in the 1930s as well, which is all about building this front between German wage earners and big industrial bosses who were like, we are not Jewish unproductive capital because we actually produce things. We can produce things you can drop on your toe and your toe will break. And this producerist ideal obviously also returns to the late 20th century.
And finally, at the end of the piece, you say the way out of populism is through it. What do you mean by that?
The way I phrase it is that they pose very important questions, but they don't have all the answers. So I don't want to dismiss them because, as I said, questions like democratizing the corporation or combining democracy and complexity are questions that haven't gone away. And I think there is a danger of a kind of technocratic managerialism, even in contemporary socialism, which populism is a valuable remedy against. So that doesn't mean we have to take on their ideology, but we actually have to take them seriously, both as people we're in a conversation with and as antagonists.
I think Slavoj Žižek would say traverse the fantasy.
It is a fantasy, but as Žižek would also say, you have to take the fantasy very seriously. You have to take it at its word.
I was Anton Yeager, a graduate student in history at Cambridge, writing on the history of American populism. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go with this, another song from that new Lana Del Rey album. Hope is a dangerous thing for a woman like me to have, but I have it. Till next week, bye.
Maybe I'd get less stressed if I was tested less, like all of these debutantes smiling for miles in pink dresses and high heels and white yachts. But I'm not, baby, I'm not. No, I'm not. That I'm not. I've been tearing around in my fucking nightgown 24/7 Sylvia Plath, writing in blood on my walls, cause the ink in my pen don't work in my notepad. Don't ask if I'm happy, you know that I'm not, but at best I can say I'm not sad. Cause hope is a dangerous thing for a woman like me to have. Hope is a dangerous thing for a woman like me to have.